This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It's very important to talk about nature and to talk about how nature is in you, not just outside of you. Because in fact, there's a part of the brain that connects you to nature. Your brain is physically attuned to connect you to the natural world. It is a reason why when you go to a beautiful place, you feel wonderful.
They say actions speak louder than words, but words are pretty important too. This week and next on Sea Change Radio, we welcome George Lakoff, the prolific author and longtime professor of cognitive linguistics from UC Berkeley. He discusses the significant concept of linguistic framing and how it relates to both progressives and conservatives. He also applies framing principles to environmental concerns and explores what benefit might be felt by reframing the movement's current messaging. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by George Lakoff. He is the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Distinguished Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. And he's the author of over a dozen books. His latest is The Little Blue Book, which he's co-authored with Elizabeth Vailing. George, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
A pleasure to be here.
First, let me read a quote about framing, which is one of the more important parts of your work. Frame systems are organized in terms of values, and how we reason reflects our values, and our values determine our sense of identity. Changing the frame systems around the environment is tough because of the two value systems entrenched in this country and in many others, obviously. Can you summarize both the conservative and progressive framing systems in a paragraph or two?
What I found out when I started looking at conservative values was the following. I asked the question, why is it that certain positions fit together? Why is it that conservatives are against abortion and for the flat tax or against taxation? What does taxation have to do with abortion? They're against environmentalism. What does that have to do with abortion? They're against letting immigrants into the country. What does that have to do with environmentalism? What does that have to do with all these other issues? And, when I asked that question, I asked about myself. I said, I have the opposite views. What does that have to do with my views? And I couldn't answer that for a while, but I realized that it was a problem in my field. I study conceptual systems. I study how people organize their thought, how people think, and how language is expressed through how people think. And what I discovered was that there's a certain metaphor. By the way, one of the things I've spent a lot of time is the nature of metaphorical thought. Metaphor is not just in language. You think metaphorically. And what we've done is work out over the last 30 years in cognitive linguistics a way to study what unconscious thought is as well as conscious thought. So what we've discovered is the following. Every word is defined by a frame. What is a frame? It's a structure you think in terms of. Think of a restaurant. You go into the restaurant, and there's a maitre d', they seat you, there's a waiter, there's a chef, there's a menu, there's food, you pay a bill. All of those are part of a restaurant. A herd of elephants is not part of the restaurant, right? It's not there. There's, you have a structure of certain things that are in there and certain things that are done there, and that's called a frame. And every word you have is defined that way. Take a word like waiter. You say waiter, you've got a restaurant. It activates that. Well, that works very, very well. And when George Bush first took office, on his first day, he used the term tax relief. And every day thereafter, for months, he used the word tax relief every time he gave a talk or an interview. And what that means is the following. If you take a word like relief, it has a frame. It says there's some affliction. You are afflicted with something bad. Anybody who you want relief from this affliction, someone who can take that away is a hero. Anybody who wants to stop him is a bad guy. So you add tax to that and you say taxation is an affliction. It's a bad thing, etc. Now, it didn't used to be a bad thing. It used to, when I was growing up, it was your tax money at work showing all the things that were done. But no, conservatives have made it a bad thing, and that's part of the conservative system of thought. So every time you hear the word tax relief, what happens? In your brain, that frame is activated in a circuit in your brain. Whenever a circuit is activated, it gets stronger. And every time you hear it, it gets stronger and stronger and stronger, but it in turn activates the system that makes sense of it. And that system is a conservative mode of thought. So it's very important to know that certain words are conservative words that activate not just a particular frame about taxation, but a whole frame about how you live supposed to live in the world. Well, what I discovered when I started looking into this was that there was a metaphor behind it that we all have, which is the nation is family. We have founding fathers. We send our sons and daughters to war. We have homeland security. We don't want the missiles in our backyard and stuff like that. So we understand the nation as a family. And then the question is, well, what kind of family gives different understandings of the nation? And when I went into this, I just looked at the politics and worked backwards through the metaphor to see if there are two kinds of families involved. And it turned out that there were, and that they had been studied in the study of family structure, what I'll call a strict father family and a nurturing parent family.
Let me guess which is which.
You can guess which is which. It's pretty clear which is which. Okay? So a nurturing parent family says, look, you got two parents if you have two. You might have one, but you have, if you have two, they're equal. They have equal say, equal responsibility. And their job is to nurture their children. And what does nurturance mean? That empathy is the center of this. That democracy depends on citizens caring about each other and taking responsibility through their government to make life better for other citizens, to make it possible for them to be healthy, free, well-educated, to have scientific research, to have a decent economy, to have jobs that are good, to have security, to not starve, to not starve when you're old, and all of those things. That those are crucial to having a decent society. And only when you have those things can you be free to start a business. You can't start a business if there are no sewers. You can't start a business if there's no transportation, no roads, no bridges, if the airports are closed down because you don't have money for to run the airports, you're not going to have flights. You can't run a business that way. The government set up the internet, through the old ARPANET. If that hadn't happened, you'd have none of the internet. The government set up the satellite system. You wouldn't have any satellite communication, no cell phones, no GPS systems, none of those things without, the government doing its job. And that is people doing their job. It's not just the government. It's the citizens who provide for other citizens. And businesses can flourish only in that situation. And individuals can lead decent lives only in that situation. That's what progressivism is about. It begins there. And Obama has talked about this many times in many ways. And he is probably, especially in his early speeches, but sometimes in his more recent ones, made it very clear that this is how that works. Now, a conservative system is based on what I'll call a strict father family. It says the father's in charge. The father knows right from wrong. Father knows best. That there should be no authority in the family above the father, the children should have no backtalk, that kids are born bad in the sense that they don't know what right from wrong. And it's the job of the father to teach them right from wrong. How? By punishing them when they do wrong. And the punishment has to be painful enough so that they will do right and not wrong by listening to their father. And this is made clear in right-wing child rearing. Right-wing child rearing, like James Dobson and others. Now, there's an effect of this, which says you have the following logic: if, in order to learn to follow the father and do right, not wrong, you have to be disciplined, and the father has to discipline you physically so that you can be internally disciplined. And what does that mean? If you're a disciplined person, you can go out into the world, and make a living for yourself, especially if you, you know, in a free market, you can go out there and make a living. So what happens if you're not making a living? That means you're not disciplined. Well, if you're not disciplined, you can't be moral, so you deserve your poverty. That is part of the logic of conservatism.
Personal responsibility.
It's personal responsibility and only personal responsibility.
The collective is out the window there. That's a bad word.
Collective is bad, right? It's personal responsibility. If you're a conservative and you go to college, you're probably going to study business to some extent, and you're going to study marketing. And professors of marketing study cognitive science, my field, which is how people think. And they're going to teach you how people think. They think metaphorically in terms of images. And repetition matters because every time you repeat something, it sticks in your brain more. And it, not only that, when you talk about one issue, it's going to affect all issues. So they learn that. It's like branding. You know, it's the same issue, the idea of branding. You talk about one product for a company, it affects all the products for the company. You speak to me in sign language, as I'm eating a sandwich in a small cafe at a quarter to three. Well, I can respond your sign language. You're taking advantage, bringing me down. Can't you make any sound?
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to cognitive linguistics professor George Lakoff. Okay, so let's take the importance of proper language framing and relate it to environmentalism. Connect the dots, if you will.
And what does this have to do with environmentalism? Everything. First of all, take liberty. Suppose you want to build a motel on a wetland. You want to fill in the wetland and build the motel, and you've bought the land. It's your land. The land is yours to use. Why can't you fill in the wetland and build the motel? It would be, you know, they would find it immoral for a government to stop you from doing that. And the same thing is true with any use of what is called private property, because land is seen as private property, you know, there for anybody to use. Minerals are there as, you know, things to be bought and sold. In law, property law, there are certain metaphors for property. Property is a bundle of rights, and there are four rights. They are the right of transfer, you can sell it. The right of access, you can access it. The right of use, you can use it for your benefit, and the right of extraction, you can extract oil, water, whatever from it and sell it, right? Those are your bundle of rights with property. And they see that as, you know, natural, that nature is there for them, for their liberty, and that democracy and government is there to promote their liberty in doing whatever. Now, this goes against everything that environmentalists know. First, every time you try to do anything that has to do with protecting the environment, it's probably going to interfere with the liberty of some corporation or some individuals. And it's going to interfere with even the idea of liberty. So even if you're poor, you're going to vote against your own interests because you want to be a strict father in your own domain. You have those values.
As Thomas Frank in What's the Matter with Kansas really clearly was able to set forth, and this is like these people who had no vested interest in seeing X, Y, or Z enacted would somehow go along with these policies which were not helpful for their personal gain in any way.
Right, but there's a brain-based explanation for this, and that's what it is. And a history that's very important. The history goes back to the Nixon campaign. Back in 1967, Goldwater had lost badly in 64 when everybody wanted to be a liberal, when there were good union jobs and working people wanted to be liberals. But In 67, when Nixon was running, he had a problem. How does he get working people to vote for Nixon? And this is a problem that his people went out and solved. There were three major things that happened between 1964 and 1967. The first was Vietnam War protests by people in college. Many working people had been in the military, and they saw people who were against the use of the military as communists. And so Nixon called them communists and ran on an anti-communist platform. Secondly, the women's movement had come about, and a lot of working men were threatened by the idea of that they were strict fathers at home. They're threatened by the idea of radical feminism. So Nixon ran on traditional family values. And then there was the civil rights legislation of 1965, and many working men who were racist or worried about their jobs, turned out to be, against that. So Nixon ran on law and order, assuming that all African-Americans are criminals. And so he ran on law and order and against school busing because he didn't want to mix races. And so what you had in 1967 there and in the 68 race was the creation of conservative populism in a strong way.
Now we look back at how Nixon's thought of as he actually passed some pretty important environmental laws. EPA was established under him, the Clean Water Act. So maybe you can walk through from a cognitive science perspective, the brain-based determinants of public understanding when it comes to this Nixonian environmentalism to today's conservative. When did the conservation part come out of conservatism?
Well, this is a very great question. And it has to do with the brain again. Most people have both moral systems. They both, even if you're raised as a progressive, you know about strict father values, and they're there in your brain, and you can recognize them. And not only that, a lot of people who have both values about different things. For example, in the university, you have a lot of professors who are nurturant at home and nurturant in their politics, but strict fathers in the classroom, right? You easily recognize that. But you find the same thing in business. There are people who are strict fathers in business, but nurturant in their home life and in their civic life and so on. And how does this work? How can you have two opposite moral worldviews in the same brain? Each one of them is given by brain circuitry, and there's a common brain circuit type called mutual inhibition, where the activation of one circuit turns off the other, and each one turns the other off.
All right, so you're talking about biconceptionalism, and I think that when it comes to the environment, most people, if they were just talking on a completely agnostic basis, didn't know what kind of political issues were involved, they wouldn't agree on almost everything when it comes to trying to preserve the planet. But somehow the conservative framing of it has been you're a Teddy Roosevelt, outdoorsman, a sportsman, a hunter, a cowboy type image, while the environmentalist from the left has been painted as, Jimmy Carter wore that cardigan and put solar panels up on the White House, and he's tree huggers, and they're just these soft, wimpy, weak people. But it's interesting how the environmental movement has been kind of subjugated by the macho image of the conservatives and the conservation element of it. Like, I had a NASCAR driver on Sea Change Radio that I interviewed, who very right-wing Republican, but he is a pretty active conservationist. He learned his values, environmental values, by being close to the land and hunting and fishing, but he would never vote for somebody who would actually be pushing forth progressive policies that would help what he actually thinks that he wants in terms of the environment.
These are manly things to do, to go out and hunt and fish and shoot deer and shoot ducks and whatever. And there are highly progressive people who are in this. You have your senator from Montana.
Oh, do you mean Governor Brian Schweitzer?
Not Schweitzer, no. but John Tester, who comes out and says, "Hey, look, you can't take my gun away. I shoot one elk a year." and I skin it myself and butcher it myself, and I freeze it, and we eat that elk every year. And the next year, I'm going to shoot one more. And I'm a farmer. You know, I raise stuff. What do I raise? Lentils. You know, it's a very interesting thing that he comes out as very manly, having the, you know, the manly arts, the same with Brian Schweitzer. And they have nurturant views about what they're doing. And there are many people who do. And they have certain views about this. But when it comes to their politics is governed by strict father morality. And, you know, you can switch back and forth. And that happened in the Nixon administration with things like the EPA, where the duck hunters were concerned about conservationism, where conservationism was a reasonable thing. And not only that, there was smog everywhere. Los Angeles was enveloped with smog. The Cuyahoga River was burning, you know. They were worried very much. Rachel Carson's book came out in The Silent Spring, and they got people seriously got concerned with pollution. So the EPA was seen as stopping pollution, getting rid of smog, which it has done to a large extent. You know, that's why you have the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act for those things. And someone like Nixon could perfectly well say that. And people who are running corporations could perfectly well say, hey, you know, I have a company in L.A. and smog isn't good for this company. And it's not good for people there.
It's bad for business.
It's bad for business. And that's how it was seen back then. What there's a big change that happened with Reagan, where Reagan said we have to get the values of the country right, that this is a moral issue. He saw it as having to do with communism and so on. Government was the enemy because it was like communism. It was collectivist, and that was bad. It's personal responsibility. And you got that with Reagan. And then in 1994, when the Republicans took over Congress, you had Frank Luntz being hired to write the contract with America and to start actively framing. And the think tanks had been developed earlier. The think tanks had been developed in back in 71 with the Lewis Powell memo. Now, how does this affect environmentalism everywhere? And let me give you one effect that people don't notice. It has to do with causation. Every language in the whole world has in its grammar, in its very grammar, the ability to express direct causation. Direct causation is something like picking up a glass, you apply a force, you move it right then. That's direct causation. And you can predict it. You know, I'm going to pick up this glass now. I just did it, okay? And you can see it. It's direct. But the environment works by systemic causation. The environment's a system. And no language in the world has systemic causation in its grammar. You have to learn about systemic causation. And it doesn't really fit conservatism that well. That is, if you think about a strict father, you know, raising his kid, it's like, do what I say now or else I'll punish you, right? Direct causation all along. And you find direct causation as a major theme in conservatism. So you have things like, how could there be global warming? We have the biggest snowstorm in Washington we've ever seen. This climate change idea was Frank Luntz. Working for Bush, came up, said, stop, global warming sounds like it's bad, and that's caused by people. Let's go to climate change. Climate sounds nice. It sounds like Hawaii or something. You think palm trees. Change just happens. Okay, so you get climate change substituting for global warming.
Why?
Why? Because people think that weather isn't controllable. You know, you can't do anything about the weather. It's just going to happen.
See, but I remember when I hear the global warming used by Republicans saying, oh, it's really cold today. See, there's no global warming in that. And
right.
So I thought actually progressives shifted it to climate change, but it was the conservatives, you're saying.
Well, the conservatives shifted to climate change, and the progressives took it over, and they didn't use it properly. So when the conservatives said that, nobody talked about systemic causation. Why is it snowing in Washington? Because of global warming in the Pacific Ocean. Global warming in the Pacific Ocean means you have more evaporation of water than you ever had before. Nobody said Hurricane Sandy, you know, had anything to do with global warming. Because the scientists are always talking about, oh, we can't predict it. They assume science is predictive rather than explanatory. See, there's an assumption that, you know, science must be able to predict rather than explain. And most people don't understand science, and the scientists don't know how to talk about their own science. They can explain what really happened. They did. But none of them came out and said this was causation, systemic causation.
And you think that's as simple as that? If you were a politician and you were given this platform to talk about environmental issues, would you just be connecting those dots to global warming, or is there more to that, linguistically?
You have to talk about, you have to introduce language for systemic causation. You have to say, this is a system, and then it takes 30 seconds or less to explain what happened. And you have to repeat it over and over.
You're just too marvelous. Too marvelous for words, like glorious, glamorous, in that old standby amorous. It's all too wonderful. I'll never find the words that say enough, tell enough. I mean, they just aren't swell enough. You're much too much. And just too very, very to ever be in Webster's dictionary. And so I'm borrowing a love song from the birds to tell you that you're marvelous, too marvelous for words.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to cognitive linguistics professor George Lakoff.
So in 2012, the fossil fuel companies outspent the clean energy proponents 4-1, at least. And the messaging, if you just, on a Sunday afternoon, if you're watching football and you see a few Shell or ExxonMobil or BP commercials, you're going to see these terms that are test marketed, focus grouped up the wazoo. And I'm sure that makes someone like your blood boil when you see like energy future and our energy needs and
people energy.
People, yes, putting people to work. And so how can environmentalists compete in this? Even the term clean energy has been co-opted by the fossil fuel companies.
Right, exactly. They say, oh, yes, this is clean energy. Well, first of all, you got to talk about it as dirty energy. And you got to talk about it as destructive energy. And there's a very important thing about the environment. The word environment itself is a problem. Because the environment is outside of you, but it's really inside of you. You breathe the air, you drink the water, you eat the food. It comes inside your body.
Is nature better?
Nature is better. Nature is a lot better. You know, it's very important to talk about nature and to talk about how you are part of, how nature is in you, not just outside of you. How nature is part of you, because in fact, there's a part of the brain that connects you to nature. Physically, your brain is physically attuned to connect you to the natural world. There's a reason why when you go to a beautiful place, you feel wonderful.
He's the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Distinguished Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley, George Lakoff. George, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by the Beastie Boys, Eric Clapton, and Frank Sinatra.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.